Welcome to We Mentor Mondays with Nancy podcast. Get inspired. Break through to new dimensions with your entrepreneurial peers on the journey of self-leadership mastery and life success. Reinvent or evolve yourself as you redesign your business. Dual innovation. Take charge of who you next become. Feel more deeply to think, act, lead, and mentor more clearly and more effectively. Learn something new from our conversation today.
Nancy, thank you so much for allowing me to participate in this conversation. I learned that it is important to continue having these conversations as often and as frequently as possible, and in all areas of your spheres of influence, not only your work, but your personal life as well.
Welcome to We Mentor Mondays. I'm Nancy. This three-part series intends to broaden our awareness, expand our ability to empathize, spark ideas for more inclusive and diversity, and broaden our understanding of cultural competency in the workplace. Why not learn more ways to be inclusive, celebrate our differences, and work toward cultural excellency in the workplace? I think we can do it. One meaningful conversation and interaction at a time. So in our first conversation, Karen McCabe from McGough Construction joined us. She's a 22-year veteran at McGough Construction, and they are known as a world-class construction, facilities management, and development business. And she was sharing what she has done within the industry, along with sharing kind of her upbringing, growing up in a really large family, seven children and two parents. And her dad was a St. Paul police officer and her mom a nurse, and some of her interests of reading and being a lifelong learner. And she's really moved into this role at McGough to really bridge the gap between diversity and inclusion and really put in some practices that help them arrive at some cultural competency. And they're doing this in four different areas. So they're doing this through policies and procedures, investigating the language and the rigidity and some of the how they practice their policies. And they're working to eliminate implicit bias. They're also working on cultural competency by having brown bag lunches and micro-learning programs and practicing having diverse conversations. In their third area, they're recruiting and hiring and looking at their practices and figuring out how to be more diverse in their hiring practices. The fourth one is about employee advancement and engagement. So clearing a pathway for requirements and having skills for people to be able to advance so that it's more transparent. And so in today's conversation with guest mentor Wendy Sullivan, we're going to learn about her multi-venture entrepreneurial journey navigating the real estate and construction industries. We're diving into the trades to understand how two women in particular are experiencing diversity and inclusion and how they're practicing through their relationship in their separate companies, but also in their relationship with each other, cultural diversity. So ponder this question. In order to reach cultural competency, do we need to know about generational trauma? Wendy and I will have a brief conversation to help us answer that question. Hi, Wendy.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm great. How are you today?
I'm great, too. I'm really excited to talk with you. And I want to give the audience just a little bit more about your background. So Wendy Sullivan is the founder and owner of Wenrich PD Construction LLC. As a multi-venture entrepreneur for most of her career, she has owned multiple businesses over the past 30 years. She has held a residential general contractor's license since 2006 and a real estate license since 1990. Wendy is a lifelong resident of Minnesota with roots in the western suburbs. She is an alumni of the University of Minnesota, graduating with a degree in sociology. She is active in her community, participating on various committees and organizations promoting fairness, justice, and equality for women and minority businesses and all human beings. So welcome to We Mentor Mondays with Nancy.
Thank you for having me, Nancy.
Yeah, what was it like growing up in your entrepreneurial home?
Yeah, my father definitely was an entrepreneur, and probably because he had to be. He was not the ideal employee. He was often late and he beat to his own drum. And I think he found the solution to that is to work for himself. We have generations on my dad's side of salespeople. And so my great grandfather was a salesperson, my grandfather was, and so was my father. And I ended up also early in my career being a salesperson. So I think that they were able to mark their own schedule, frame their own future and their goals and how they wanted to earn money for a living. And I think that was appealing to them and the flexibility of being an entrepreneur. I think they worked very hard, but also that freedom and flexibility to do things your own way was very appealing to them and appealing to me.
Yeah. I was really struck by where you grew up. You went from Michigan to Ottawa, Canada, to Groton, Connecticut, to Minneapolis, to the West Suburbs, to San Diego, California, to Torrance, California, to Redondo Beach, California, to Yugoslavia. 13 times you moved before you graduated high school. I'm just like, how did you navigate that?
I didn't have a lot of choice in the matter, but I will say that my father was a math major, and he was very talented. And he also was a computer analyst, which back then was a big deal. And the computers took up the entire room of a place where they don't have PCs. This is an early time. So he was in very high demand. So the early part of my life, we moved around because of his work and him being in high demand. And he actually didn't have to go to Vietnam because he was working for a government company with the computers. And so he didn't need to go overseas. It was considered that he was serving because he was doing that with the computers. So that's the early part of my life. My parents divorced early when we got back to Minnesota. And my mom actually moved a lot. So she's the California one. She moved a lot almost every other year. So I was with one parent for one reason or another. And then I would come back and live with her. And then she would have moved. And so that's how that happened. And I think I didn't know anything different. But the benefit of that was that I was able to read a room very well. I learned very quickly how to assess a situation, figure out who was to know, who was not to know, what group to be in, what not group to be in. And then I also got to reinvent myself at any point in time if it wasn't going well. So if I wrong decision, I was like, oh, in a few months we'll be leaving here, so I can just do this all over again. And I didn't know any different. And so I think there were a lot of benefits that came from that. And maybe on not so good side, my attachment or that piece probably isn't as strong as it could be. But again, I don't see it as a negative. It helped with me in sales. It helped me. I was never shy. I was forced not to be. And so I think that's a good thing. And I think there were a lot of benefits out of it. I don't know. I didn't do that with my children. We stayed put pretty much, but I don't think it was all bad.
So, yeah.
As a matter of fact, good.
And how many siblings did you grow up with? And at what age did your parents divorce?
So
what age were you?
Story. My parents divorced when I was 2, got back together till I was 6. And then 10 years later, they got back together when I was 16, and they did not again stay together. But so there was a little bit of that. I did grow up an only child, and I am my only child of my parents. So I was an only child.
Okay. And how did your family address or overcome the life-changing challenges then with both? So you lived equally with both parents, or how did that work out if you were reflected in your schooling?
Okay. It was just changes that happened and decisions that were made. And then they'd say, my mom would say, I'm going to move here. So I'm going to have you go stay with your dad for a while until I get settled. Or as I got to be a teenager, maybe I didn't feel like I wanted to be in any particular place. And then I'd live with the other parent. It was not a planned situation.
Okay. That would be, changing the different schools. So that was your life-changing events were constant.
Very much so.
When did you notice that you began asserting self-leadership?
I think it started early on. Again, I don't want this to be taken as me throwing my parents under the bus by any means, but I was left alone a lot. And so they both worked and they both were doing their life. And so I had to take care of myself from a very early age by myself. And so again, I didn't know any different and I just worked through it. And I, again, was not shy because I wasn't allowed to be shy changing schools. And so I think I was trained to be a leader for myself and to advocate for myself at a very early age. I don't know. Sometimes it's nurture or nature. I don't know if I would have been, everything in your experience makes you who you are, but I don't know if I was wired that way already. And so I was able to navigate that, or if because of my circumstances, it created that.
Oh, I see. Sure. And you and I were able to meet in person a couple of times. I really appreciate that before today's conversation, and then one conversation online with Karen and I. And as you shared your entrepreneurial journey, I was really struck with how many mentors you've had in your life. Your dad was your first entrepreneurial mentor, and I understood him to be in the real estate industry. Can you help me understand how he went from the computer industry to real estate and how that took shape in your life?
Yeah, sure. In the 70s, my dad jumped on the bandwagon with, there was a big boom of real estate transactions and things happening back then. And he owned a lot of rental property from what I remember. And I was young. I think he got his license in early 70s. And so there was a group of them that were, it just was a boom of the real estate market, which happens, it goes up and down all the time. And so he started riding that and he took a liking to it and kept going. And he ended up opening Sullivan Realty in a few years and had that for until he passed away last year. And so it was a part of my life. I got my real estate license early on. I owned my first property that I lived in when I was 19. I bought a condo near the U where I was going to school, and it was a two bedroom. And then I had a roommate, so she covered my mortgage payment, and it was just what I was taught to do. And I have passed that on to my children. Both my sons have owned their property, 118, 119. They had a duplex, both of them, and that was their income during the whole time that they were in school and college, and they still own them now. And my other son, one of my sons owns quite a few now. So it was a part of our life, and real estate was, and always talked about as a great investment piece, and that someone's always going to need a place to live. So that was part of that. So he, yes, was first. And it's funny, I never realized that I didn't call them mentors, but in our conversation in my 55 years, you were the first person that kind of saw that thread. And I think having to navigate a lot of life on my own, yeah, I probably sought those people out and asked the questions and tried to figure things out so I understood how to navigate things. And there were people that stepped up and did and were mentors for me, but I didn't think about it like that until, because it wasn't a formal, you know, mentorship type thing, but you're right, that's what they were.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's so great that you were able to ask for help when you need it and that people respond in such a positive way. You have a fun story about when you realized that you had your entrepreneurial dad's spirit. You want to share that?
I have so many stories. I'm not sure if I remember which one. We talked about so much. Can you refresh my memory on which one it was?
Yeah. Your dad was a salesperson, and you mentioned that your grandfather and your great-grandfather were also salespeople. And early on, as a salesperson, you sold Girl Scout cookies.
Right. So fourth grade, we had, I was in Girl Scouts and they said, okay, we're going to sell the cookies. And at that time you would go door to door. Your parents didn't really help you with that. I knocked it out of the park. I was just so determined to be there. And the gap, I don't remember now, but the gap, I don't remember the exact number, but the gap between how many I sold and the person underneath me was like huge. I was there. So I remember my dad telling me, which I don't know if I shared this with you, but he sold 2-volume encyclopedias, Lincoln encyclopedias, when he was in college. And he was the number one salesperson then. And I remember him telling me that story. And coincidentally, which I don't think I also didn't share with you, I sold encyclopedias during college as well and traveled all over the Midwest. I wasn't as successful as he was with the encyclopedias, but so I did that as well. In middle school, I made flyers in an apartment building my mom was living in and left them at the door to pick up house cleaning jobs and babysitting. And I was young for my grade, so I think I was 11 at the time going into seventh grade. And so I had earned all my money summer to buy all of my clothes, and I was so proud of that. And I think Karen talked about that in her interview about just earning your own money and how rewarding that feels.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I was working too in high school and on the dairy farm. I was a nurse's aide in high school, and it's really fun to have your own money. Who helped you get into the rehab business where you bought so we're leaping ahead a little bit, where you bought distressed properties, you remodeled them, and then you rented them out?
Yeah, I was doing another venture with a boss of mine for my sales company. I think I mentioned I was in sales and I was in corporate sales, and I was thinking about going on my own. And so I called my dad and I said, hey, I'm going to do this thing on my own, but I need to be able to eat. So I'm thinking about buying a duplex, and can you help me out with that? And of course, he was still doing real estate at the time. This was in 2002. And so he said, yeah, so we found one. And I bought the first one, and then it needed work to get it up to par. I got it rented. And then I was like, oh, wow, this money's coming every month. This is nice. And so I kept buying properties, and it took a life of its own. And for 19 years, I did that. And at the first part of that, they said, oh, you can only own, you know, four in your own name. But it was during right before, I guess, a few years, 4 years or so before things started to, you know, decline. And there was the big crash.
Yeah.
But they kept letting me get them. So I kept getting them. So I kept buying them. And so at one point I had 47 properties that I was managing myself, and my little venture that I was going to do on the corporate side fell by the
way. Okay.
So that was part of my life for 19 years. Yeah.
And your first company then was Wenrich Property and Development, or your real estate company was Wenrich Property and Development, LLC.
Yep, that's correct. Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
So you bought your first duplex in 2002, and then you really bumped it up to get the 47 properties by 2008. Is that right?
I had the 47 properties earlier than that. Probably about 2006 is when I capped out.
Mm-hmm. Okay, you capped out. And then what happened after that, as we're approaching 2008, what was going on?
During that time, there was a lot of no doc, stated income, no doc loans. So you could go in and say, here's what I'm making, and you wouldn't have to give any documentation, which was part of the reason that we had the housing crash. But I was refinancing, buying more places and going forth. And then there was a crash. And the places next door were selling for $30,000 next to mine. I had a mortgage for, you know, $250,000, let's say. And I contacted the bank and said, why are you able to sell this place for $30,000, or the market's bearing this and I'm paying you this? So I talked to some of them, renegotiated with me because they were losing places left and right. So I did that. And then I let some of them go. I said, I could let this go and buy a place for $30,000 and own it free and clear and not have to have a mortgage of $250,000. It was a huge decision, just because when you get a loan, you should pay it back and all of that. But I saw what was happening at the market and I thought, this is ridiculous. My counterpart investors are getting homes for $30,000 and I'm paying a mortgage on $250,000 right next door.
Yeah. What's wrong with this picture?
Exactly.
So you went from 47 properties to 15. Was that after that realization?
Yes. So the 15, I was really able to get the same amount of return or close to with that much less work from managing 47 properties to 15, because I own the 15 free and clear. So there was no mortgage, and all the money that was coming in for rent, less any maintenance expenses, I was receiving the full amount versus 47, where I may have had some places I was right at the cusp, just covering things, breaking even, other ones, a couple hundred dollars a property. So I could do less work and earn just as much.
And so during the process of that, there was an impact that was felt. Who was affected as you were letting go of these properties?
I guess on the very light side of that, before I made the decision, I had to think about how it was going to impact my family. This, I was a single parent of three at the time, and it's, okay, am I going to need a car, or am I going to need to do anything with my home? Because at that point, if I wouldn't have the credit to purchase anything, it would have to be cash because it was going to take a long time to recover. So the immediate impact on my family and our position credit-wise was huge. I contributed, I suppose, to the housing crash along with many other people, investors and homeowners, which impacted our whole nation. But it didn't affect the tenants. Tenants were protected when homes were going in foreclosure. And I was very open and honest with my tenants. I had some tenants that had been with me at several different properties, and I was a hands-on landlord, so I knew most of them. And I was very honest about what I was going through and what I had decided to do and let them know their rights and that sort of thing. And so although it impacted them at some point they'd have to move, they were prepared. And
so they could plan ahead
what was happening.
Yeah. Okay. And how do you feel reflecting on that now?
I think that it was just wise. It was the right decision. And I think I made the best decision that I could at the time. But I think I still carry when you don't finish something that you've committed. I don't know that it impacts me daily, but it is something. But I think I was in a women ventures class and they talked about the difference between women holding what happens to be a loan versus the entitlement of studies have been done, the entitlement of a male in a loan and business decisions versus women. So I think maybe we carry that more so than maybe somewhat our male counterparts. And they shared that with me and it gave me some levity. I felt a little better about it.
Yeah. And in 2020, you sold those 15 properties. What's the status of Wenrich Property Development LLC now?
It still exists. I kept the LLC going. I don't have any holdings in it right now, property holdings, but I'm looking to possibly do some short-term rentals once I get the construction company where I want it to be or moving further in the direction I want it to be. I don't think I'll ever lose that need to have property and own land. So I just ingrained in me so much that I feel empty without it almost.
Yeah. It's part of your life work in being here. Do you feel like a legacy?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So in 2011, before this happened, you had another significant life change. An electrical fire burned your house to the ground. A year-long fight with an insurance company ensued, and the rebuilding of your home didn't go as planned. A tough time. How did you land back on your feet?
This time era, that decade, so it's been a decade, I guess, 2011 till now, has been, with regard to my house, that first 8 years of that 10 was one of the most difficult times in my life. The fire was like a loss of the death, and then to be displaced and navigating the insurance company on my own and not having been through that before to figure that out was tough, and not knowing who to trust and what they were telling me. I did finally hire one of the only female insurance adjusters, private insurance adjusters. She helped me navigate that, which was awesome. And we still talk from time to time, even now.
Another mentor.
There you go. Yeah. And she's probably about 20 years my senior. So yeah, she's just a fabulous woman. And I think that the biggest hit to that, as I got through that, was a builder that someone I knew and thought I could trust left with, after the second draw, there's only four. One draw is 25% of what you're getting for your build from the insurance company or from the mortgage company, but originally from the insurance company as they divvy it out. And he took the first draw and did some things that looked like that was great progress and took the second one and then didn't finish. Mm-hmm. And I had a 3-year-long fight in court with him, only to be given from the builder's fund $75,000, which was not you know, anywhere near what I needed to make that up. In addition, he had a lot of mistakes that he had done and things that he had not done well. So that also impacted me with the dollar amount. And of that 75 that they give you, I had to give 20,000 of it to the attorney. Hmm. So I was left with $55,000 to make up for about $400,000 of what I had to make up from his mistakes and the money he had taken.
Wow.
Yeah, it was tough. And I think my biggest regret of that whole situation and my decision-making as a parent was that I am trying to encourage myself and trying to figure it out for myself. I led my daughter along to say that it'll be just a bit longer. Yep, I think we're going to be able to make it by this month. And I was really trying to encourage myself because I felt like if I verbalized that I couldn't do it, I would give up. Mm. But unfortunately, I was stringing her along. And so she kept thinking we were almost there, and it was 8 years. And that's a huge part of her life. She's 21. So she was from 11 until 19 that she didn't have, we didn't have a place we called home, versus if I had said, we're not going to do this right now and made a place our home and not shared with her, we're almost there for 8 years.
Oh, yeah.
So I that goes down as one of my, I don't have a lot of regrets, but that goes down as one of my biggest regrets in my life.
Yeah. And it sounds repairable. Your daughter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, for sure. But you can't get 8 years back. And that was.
No, you can't. Yeah.
But we're fine. We ended up, again, awful tragedy with COVID, but we got a second chance. She was with me as the house became, we got our occupancy and she got to spend a year and a half with me because of COVID and they were learning remote after she had gone to college. And so we actually got to live that out. And it was, I can't tell you how many days we cried and just of joy that I can't, or even remark and say, I can't believe we're here and I can't believe we did it. And so that was some healing and for what we had gone through.
Well, yeah. It sounds, again, perseverance, and you achieved your goal. You didn't know how long it would take, but you got there and it was really tough because you also had moved like 5 times during that time. So that's where, and you were used to moving, right? So that might not have seemed like such a big deal. Or I don't know. I don't want to put words in your mouth.
It was a long time that I had moved, but I don't know that she was used to it. And I think it shook her world more than anything. It was more about her than me.
Yeah.
But I think that we also initially had the insurance company paying for a year. And then I stretched that out a little bit with some negotiation from them. But then each place we went to, because I still was paying my mortgage on the house that I was trying to build, there's only so many funds and there's only so much money. So
yeah,
I was paying for 2 places. And so we didn't have the quality of places that I would have liked for her throughout the latter part of it as I was trying to work things out. But again, we appreciate what we have so much. And so we're just moving it into our next chapter.
Yeah, that's a beautiful thing that you're able to repair and kind of come to terms with it and explore it and from different angles. That's part of the healing. And it might come back a little bit more as a few years down the road. I wonder if it also helps you with, based on how many times you moved during that same time frame when you were 11 to 19. Did you have any kind of flashbacks about that or for yourself? While your daughter was going through this?
I don't, it's funny. Again, you're just giving me all these revelations. I don't know that I thought about it like that. I don't feel like it affected me. Like if absent her, I probably wouldn't have cared. But I did get a little thrill as I think back about getting into a new place and changing the furniture around and doing some different things. And I remember doing that with my mom. So I guess I did have some flashbacks of that. Again, not in a very positive way, and just having fun with it and getting new furniture or different furniture or arranging things different ways, depending on which place we moved to. Yeah. So I guess I would have some flashback as I think back that was very reminiscent of my time with my mom.
Nice memories then. with your mom. Yeah. So you joined three organizations, the Association for Women Contractors, the National Association of Minority Contractors, and Associated General Contractors of Minnesota. I'm bringing this up because it's also part of the mentoring you experienced, but also how you have built out kind of your career by staying connected in organizations that have similar missions to what you're wanting to be doing in the world, and places to develop long-term relationships. How have they helped you understand and grow with your life work?
Yeah, and I just want to say too that the reason I don't tell that story about the fire very much, but yeah. One of the reasons I started my construction company was to get another stream of revenue so that I could get my house built. Just FYI, I don't know if I shared that with you when we met. And so the first thing I did was like, okay, what could I do to earn another stream of income that I could use for the house? That was my goal. And I went to the National Association of Minority Contractors first because I knew about them, coincidentally, because when I used to sell corporately, they were one of my customers. So I popped into one of their meetings. There were some familiar faces of people I knew from the community and talked to them about what I needed to do. And they said, you need to find a niche. I mean, you can't be a general contractor like McGough or Knudsen and some of those other folks and Mortensen or whatever, the big guys. And I said, okay. And then my ex-husband knew someone that knew someone at the AGC of Minnesota. And I think that phrase came up, but it's not what you
said. Oh, yeah, earlier. Karen brought that up, yeah.
So I got a meeting with Dave Semerad, who used to run the AGC of Minnesota. And he brought everyone, it's a small office, but he brought everyone in the office and said, okay, tell us about what you're going to do. And I was like, oh my gosh, I don't know what I'm going to do. I came to talk to you one-on-one to try to figure out what I might do. So they started firing questions at me. And I had thought about, because I knew MnDOT was struggling with meeting their minority and women-owned goals that they have set on road projects. So I threw out there, I go, oh, what about guardrails? And so Tim Werke, who was now the head of AGC of Minnesota, but at the time he had a different position. He says, no one, there's only two players. They're never going to let you in. You won't have the buying power. You want to this. And so I was like sitting there going, geez, should I just go home? Maybe this was a bad idea. But Martha Hendrickson, who is no longer there, but now works at Mortensen, said to me, hey, what about fencing? That's similar. Did you do any fencing on the residential side? And I was like, yeah, sometimes we did. She goes, well, what about that? And so I have to give her credit. I didn't see her until 4 years later because she left shortly after that. I saw her at an event and told her she's the reason that I do fencing. So she suggested fencing. That was my niche scope. And that's what I dug into. And then they have continued.
And this was in 2015? This was before 2015.
And they have continued to be a great resource for me. They're geared towards general contractors, and I'm a subcontractor. And so I try to participate as much as I can to give them a female and minority lens on things. They are trying to move that direction, but I think it's hard, as I think you talked about in the first segment, about just trying to change the perspective of general contractors or a white male dominated industry. Yeah. And they're making attempts on there. They've got a long way to go. They're making attempts. And so I try to participate as much as I can. And you had asked me, AWC, which is Association for Women Contractors, is a very, oh my gosh, I don't know how I would have made it through some of the difficult times without them. I think they are very well established. I think the executive director, Barb Lau, does a fabulous job in connecting women and being a voice for them. And matter of fact, that's how I met Karen at McGough. She was part of the membership committee, and she reached out to welcome me as a member and said, hey, I've got free time on this Tuesday or whatever day it was. And she said, I only have about a half hour, 45 minutes because I have some people coming to install some appliances. And I said, oh, okay, I can meet you. So we decided to meet for coffee. So luckily for me, they were supposed to call her when they were 30 minutes away or something. They didn't call her for 2 hours, and we talked for 2 hours. We nonstop. It was like, I can't even explain. It was like we connected. I feel like we connected so much during that conversation, and I heard her journey in construction, and it was so inspiring and made me so excited about construction. And she has been really intertwined throughout, before we had a mentorship with McGough, but intertwined in my journey as a construction business owner throughout, from like almost day one, because this was very early on. So it's wonderful. There other organization that I don't want to leave out of this and mentioning is National Association for Minority Contractors. And I just want to say, as you've talked about some of the things with the different diverse groups, NAMC is National Association for Minority Contractors, and their whole goal is to be a voice similar to AWC, but a voice for the community of color and people of color. And they have, you know, struggled a lot in trying to keep themselves steady within our community, mainly because they don't have an executive director. But, and I served on their board for a couple of years, and it's a working board, what makes it difficult for small businesses to be a part of that when they're trying to run their own business. But they are a very necessary one. And so my hopes within all of the things, the unrest and George Floyd and all of that, that the things that happened in the last couple of years, that our community and our state will look at the construction industry and really reach out and help that organization become strong. I'm on their development committee, and I'm hoping to reach out and get some of our general contractors, because it's a voice that needs to be heard, and especially for the BIPOC community, which I don't know if you've talked about that on other episode podcasts, but it's Black and Indigenous people of color. So it's a different group, and it's really geared towards those, for lack of a better term, the slave descendants, Black slave descendants, and Native Americans or Indigenous people, because those are the two that seem to very often get left behind and didn't make a choice being here or being pushed out of the mainstream of America. And so there's a lot of work, and that word comes up, BIPOC, a lot, and just trying to figure that out. And that NAMC is a place where that voice in the construction industry for the BIPOC community that can be heard. So I'm hoping that develops in the near future.
That also brings up what we talked about in one of our other conversations too, about generational trauma. And just to give a brief definition, so generational trauma is precisely what it sounds like, according to Dr. Melanie English in a Health magazine article that I read. And so generational trauma is precisely what it sounds like, trauma that isn't just experienced by one person, but extends from one generation to the next. It can be silent, covert, and undefined, surfacing through nuances and inadvertently taught or implied throughout someone's life from an early age onward. I had a conversation with a woman I've known for a while, a Black woman. Her family was struggling with what happened to her family, who didn't want to come over here. Her ancestors were slaves. And that she said it has had a profound effect in her life 50 or 60 years later. I started this conversation with, do we need to understand generational trauma in order to gather a larger perspective of what someone is coming through in order to work together? How does generational trauma, how has it affected you in your life work? And feel free to comment on anything that I just have said.
Okay. I think one of the things that struck me in the last segment is you talked about your heritage and the dairy farmer and some of that piece. And then Karen talked about some of that piece. But if you can imagine, and I can only, you know, speak on the Black perspective, I can't speak on Indigenous people because that's not part of my heritage, and I wouldn't want to misspeak on that. But if you think about slave descendants and what happened, they're disconnected from their community. They put different African tribes together so that they didn't speak the same language. So there's this whole disconnect that there is no history. And I guess I should say this, I'm biracial. So my dad is Caucasian and my mom is African-American slave descendant. And
oh,
so
she is. Okay.
When I looked for my father's heritage, we have all kinds of connections and green leaves that come up and all the way through. And for my mom's, it stops at a certain point. There isn't a lot of history because you're disconnected. You have no idea where you're from. So there's a whole sense of displacement. that is ingrained in a slave descendant. That doesn't happen with an immigrant, because an immigrant makes a choice to come here, and they also know their heritage, right? Because they're coming from their country. Slave descendants don't have that. And even Native Americans, I would assume, they know where they're from, and they have a very rich heritage. African slave descendants are just plopped here with no placement. You're displaced. And that trauma is huge. You never feel apart. You're not able to sit at a table and talk about how far back your heritage goes back. I can trace my dad's history all the way to Cork County, and I can't do that with my mom. We can only go back a few generations. And that's a lot of trauma to be feel displaced and not a part of. And I think there's also a lot of triggers as well when you see allocations going out, whether it's construction or any other thing. And even, I think you mentioned something that they were looking at doing something for Native American Africans.
Like sorry to interrupt, but I just want to add piece mm-hmm. in with the Bush Foundation has designated $100 million over the next few years to be invested in indigenous communities within the Midwest.
That's absolutely awesome. And I think that's great. And they've had a lot of trauma. And I've been watching some of those and having conversations about their trauma that has happened over the years with all of the things that have been recently, revealed. But the slave descendants, reparations is never approved. It's never given any credence. The African American slave descendant population built this country for free. The state capital, all the, and there's, it's always the group that seems to be left out. And thankfully for the Native Americans, they had treaties and things like that. That isn't the case, which differs for the slave descendant population. And so I think there's a lot of healing that needs to happen, but you can't even get past the acknowledgement of it. It's discussed in school in February, maybe, I don't know, and sometimes not even. And I think
it's never talked about. It's never talked about in terms of reparations. It's never talked about in terms of how the degree of displacement that people have felt, and how it's like starting your own culture, over.
Mm-hmm.
And where do you even connect? It's so deep, that it's not talked about in enough detail at all in our schools.
Yeah. I'll make one little caveat too that happens. There's colorism too that has been such a big part of generational trauma. And I experience that personally because I'm biracial. One of the unspoken things that happens is the closer you are to looking like the majority group or white, the more benefits you get. That goes back to slave times, right? And so there's a lot of infighting or things that happen within the Black community because of that. And so there's trauma related to that and issues surrounding that. And there's just a lot of things that have been put in place and they still carry true today. And that's hard. Those are triggering at different times. And I know the benefits that I have when I walk into a room that maybe my other African-American people may not. And that's hard to navigate. And so I think there's just really big issues that there are triggering all the time within the slave descendant, Black slave descendant community that are really unique. And it's really hard when you can't get a seat at the table to talk about how to make it better, or it's not acknowledged, or it's not taught, or it's not understood.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's a really big topic, and I would love to have you back to talk about some ideas of how to bridge the generational trauma. And anyways, we can sort that out at another time, but this is not the only conversation I'm going to have on the topic. I just think it's been so underrepresented that we have to shed a lot of light and have lots of conversations to create awareness, but also to figure out how best to make the reparations. And you can't really put together a culture that's been lost and displaced, but we can find a way to help them feel more belonging.
That's great. That's great.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah. One of the last questions that I have, which seems so trite after this conversation, but not equally, but companies like McGough Construction and like Target are helping to integrate operational and leadership skill sets through education in offering programs. And I also wanted to highlight as part of your mentoring that this is how you've also been learning to develop a really successful business. You want to talk a little bit about how McGough Construction and Target helped you with developing your operational understanding of your business and also grow into your leadership role?
Yeah, I definitely. I mean, I think this is really important actually in talking about the generational trauma. One of the things that has to happen is that there needs to be more businesses from the BIPOC community that will be a safe place for employees from those communities to be a part of. And that's one of my missions, is to provide employment and leadership and management roles for marginalized people of our community, and offering second chances for hiring staff and making them a part of and allowing them to grow as individuals and leaders and be in those places where they're sitting at the table because they're a project manager or they're the CFO of my company, which I haven't hired yet because I'm not at that point. Yeah. They're in those positions in the C-suites, and then they're going to the meetings and they have a voice and they're in a position of leadership. And that's what we need to see more of from my perspective in the BIPOC community. And so McGough helping me with my internal workings and operations of my business to make it stronger and to make it last over time so that we can say we're having our 60th year anniversary. I probably won't be around for that, but it's been generation after generation. So generational wealth, right? Within the Black slave descendant community, BIPOC, Indigenous folks, and people that are normally left out or have been, creating more firms that are owned and operated with those people in it, that makes a huge difference because now all of a sudden you're on equal footing or almost equal footing with your business and you're driving things and you have a voice. So they have helped me. McGough has helped me from a legal standpoint. They've helped me navigate a couple different legal issues that I've had with other. And again, let me say this, not they've come as just advice off the record. I didn't hire them, but just to say, okay, this is how you should redline your contract, or no, that doesn't sound right. You don't need to do that. In my experience, this is what we've done with subcontractors, and knowing, because you don't know what you don't know. So they've supported me in that HR, finding out what are these roles and how should I do this? What do I need to pay this person if I'm thinking about hiring them and we're this small? Finance, what should that look like? I was working with their controller. He was meeting with me every couple of weeks to go through my cash flow analysis and all those things that I wasn't privy to. Even though my dad owned a company, he was a small real estate company and didn't have everyone's independent contractor. So he didn't have some of this stuff where you're actually hiring people. Safety, I just working through all of that, my manuals and all the things, any question I have, I can reach out to Karen and she will direct me somewhere. We're buying a building this year, hooray, of our own, which is huge. And
good
Karen is putting me, so exciting.
Yeah, congratulations.
Thank you. And Karen is putting me in touch with their development person to talk about what do they do on their development end. And I think that Target, too, has just been a leader within, and I think there's been tons of news articles about their efforts to reach out to the BIPOC community after the George Floyd tragedy last year, or I guess 2 years ago now. And they have really directed money towards the BIPOC community. And so for the last 8 months, I've been working with their controller and finance department. I have 6 people dedicated to me to comb through my stuff and say, okay, you need to turn this way. This category needs to be this way. And they've created a really simple sheet for me because I wear a lot of hats that I can glance at any time and feeds from my accounting system to say, how are we doing right now? So they've been tremendous. And I'm going to go into my second one with them helping me create forms to help with my field operations and how do we manage that so that we are getting tracking things and can address them proactively instead of after the project's over to say, oh, we didn't do so well on that one.
Yeah.
We're watching it real time and in daily basis. And so I think there's a lot of help out there. You do have to seek it out, but I think there's a lot out there and you have to, go and advocate for yourself and find those places. But hands-on is managing that for Target for the BIPOC community, and they're on their second round now. I'm on their advisory committee, just helping them better understand what some of the needs might be. And not that I speak for everyone, but just as me as a small business owner and a person of color, to what I'm struggling with to help them better serve. Karen calls me and asks me different questions about things that relate to that and being a small business owner and how she can work with people. We have a small group that I started. It's a BGM breakfast club that we've been doing for about 6 months now. And that's Black Girl Magic, because there's only Black Girl Magic breakfast club, because there's only five or six of us. I'm sorry, there's eight of us. Karen just gave me a new person. But in the whole construction industry that are business owners.
Oh my gosh.
And we're not of any size, really. We're in comparison. So that's it. And so we meet for breakfast every Friday, and we're trying to develop that. And Karen has said, McGough will host a breakfast. We're going to work on that together to get us in front of the right people. So I think Karen's efforts and McGough's commitment has been tremendous for me as a business owner, and I think, and within the construction community as well.
Yeah. Oh, that's fantastic. How many employees do you have?
Internally, I have three. So there's just three of us in the office. And I'm a union shop. So we're a little slow. We're winding down our season. But we range from about 10 to 17. And then the height of the season, we'll bring on part-time people or people that will just work for us depending on the project. And then we have about 10 people, four that are part-time for us, and then six that have been with us, some of them since my second season, and I'm going into my eighth season. So they've stuck with me.
Excellent.
But it wasn't always easy.
Yeah. And you're doing it. You're landing on your feet. You're finding the mentors you need. And I want to reinforce the importance, and I'm doing more of that. I was encouraging entrepreneurs all this time to get advisory boards, which they need, but I'm turning them into mentoring teams so that you've got people to call on during the course of the year that are specific, that you're having a couple meetings a year together, and you just make a one-year commitment at a time to be designated an entrepreneurial business. Anyways, lots of good stuff. I'm so happy with how you've been able to navigate your life and the resilience that you have with you and your family. And I'm sorry for the loss of your dad last year. That was just another shocking experience. And I just appreciate your openness and the depth of the conversation that we had today. Thanks so much.
Oh, Nancy, thank you. I appreciate being included. Thank you.
And in our third conversation, the three of us, so Wendy, you just heard from, Karen, you heard from prior to that, and myself, we're going to discuss the practical side. You've been hearing how McGough, they've made things concrete with their four different ways in which they bridge some of the work that they're doing to be more inclusive and diverse and culturally competent. You've also heard from Wendy how she's been able to experience longer-term growth with their business with mentors in corporations that are willing to help, not just for a month or two with resources, but like Target has for 8 months, or like McGough has been continually there as Wendy's building out and going to own now her own property for her business, getting help there. And so reaching out and getting mentors really makes a huge difference, because you don't have the people in your small business that work for you. You need outside mentors to help you navigate on very few resources as you go along. All right. So thanks again, Wendy. I just really appreciate you a lot. And the work that you're doing is tremendous. And I support you 100%. And thanks, everybody, for tuning in. And really think about generational trauma and how the people in our midst, what they're experiencing, and how can you be the bridge to help be more inclusive and help people feel like they belong wherever you are, in whatever conversation and whatever transaction that you're having with someone. You can extend a warm, belonging way in which you speak. And thanks, Mike Cabea, sound engineer, videographer, photographer, mon frère de notre mère, brother from another mother. And we'll see y'all next week. Thanks for tuning in.
Do you want to build upon your leadership skills and become effective as a business owner? Do you want to evolve yourself as you redesign your business? You can. We know that dual innovation with mentoring works. We've mentored thousands of emerging to experienced entrepreneurial leaders and small business owners in this dual innovation process since 1992. We are here to co-create a mentoring process where you can nourish resilient relationships while you redesign your business. Resilient relationships promote relational literacy, the ability to understand and express healthy ways of relating. Even a slight increase in relational literacy can lead to significant improvement in all of your relationships. So why not take the risk to move out of dysfunctional relating and move into ways to deepen your connection to yourself and others? Assert self-leadership. If you aren't already subscribed to this podcast, go do it now. Go to wementor.com and get the support and skills needed to build a purposeful life journey with your peers on the entrepreneurial leadership path, consciously co-creating our future. You can also join our virtual mentoring community for one-on-one strategic mentoring or participate in a WeMentor lab, because we mentor meaningful conversations and activities that lead to higher levels of functionality and engagement in our world and everything that we do with each other. So engage your curiosity and become the leader you envision yourself to be today. WeMentor.com. Go there. Check it out.